It did not need the ill omen of the flight of the falcon Nefertem to warn Taita that they had reached the most dire and fateful period in all the long history of this very Egypt. When he left Nefer's bedchamber and started out into the desert, it was as though the stars stood frozen in their courses and all the ancient gods had drawn back and deserted them, abandoning them in this their most dangerous hour.
Great Horus, we need your guidance now. You hold this Ta-Meri, this precious land, in the cup of your hands. Do not let it slip through your fingers and shatter like crystal. Do not turn your back on us now that we are in our agony. Help me, mighty falcon. Instruct me, make your wishes clear to me so that I may follow your will.
Praying as he went, he climbed the hills at the periphery of the great desert. The clicking of his long staff against the rocks alarmed a yellow jackal and sent it scampering away up the moonlit slope. When he was certain that he was not observed, he turned parallel to the river and quickened his stride.
Horus, well you know that we are balanced on the sword edge of war and defeat. Pharaoh Tahmoser has been struck down and there is no warrior to lead us. Apepi and his Hyksos in the north are grown so mighty as to have become almost invincible. They gather against us, and we cannot stand against them. The double crown of the two kingdoms is rotten with the worm of treachery, and cannot survive against the new tyranny. Open my eyes, mighty God, and show me the way, that we might triumph against the invading Hyksosian hordes from the north and against the destroying poison in our own blood.
For the rest of that day, Taita journeyed through the stony hills and the silent places, praying and searching to discover the way forward. In the late evening, he turned back towards the river and came at last to his ultimate destination. He could have chosen to come here by the direct means of a felucca, but too many eyes would have remarked his passage, and he had needed that time alone in the desert. In the deep darkness, when most men slept, he approached the temple of Bez on the river bank. A guttering torch burned in its niche above the gate. It lit the carved figure of the god Bez, which guarded the entrance. Bez was the deformed dwarf god of drunkenness and joviality. His tongue lolled out between his leering lips. In the wavering light of the torch, he gave Taita an inebriated grin as he passed. One of the temple acolytes was waiting to receive the Magus. He led him to a stone cell in the depths of the temple, where a jug of goat's milk stood on the table beside a platter of dara bread and honey in the comb. They knew that one of the Magus's weaknesses was honey from the pollen of the mimosa blossom.
"There are three men already awaiting your arrival, my lord," the young priest told him.
"Bring Bastet to me first," Taita instructed.
Bastet was the chief scribe of the Nomarch of Memphis. He was one of Taita's most valued sources of information. Not a rich man, he was burdened with two pretty but expensive wives and a brood of brats. Taita had saved his children when the yellow flowers devastated the land. Although of little consequence in the scheme of things, he sat close to the seat of power, using his ears and phenomenal memory to good effect. He had much to tell Taita of what had transpired in the nome since the accession of the new regent, and received his payment with genuine gratitude.
"Your blessing would have been sufficient payment, mighty Magus."
"Babes don't grow fat on blessings."
Taita dismissed him. Next came Obos, the high priest of the great Horus temple at Thebes. He owed his appointment to Taita, who had interceded for him with Pharaoh Tahmoser. Most of the nobles came to the temple of Horus to worship and make sacrifice, and they all confided in the high priest. The third man to report to Taita was Norrell, the secretary of the army of the north. He also was a eunuch,
and there was a bond between those who had suffered such mutilation. From the days of his youth, when Taita had first found himself directing affairs of state from the shadows behind the throne, he'd been aware of the absolute necessity of having impeccable intelligence on which to base decisions. All the rest of that night and most of the following day, he listened to these men and questioned them narrowly, so that when he was ready to return to the palace of Memnon, he was informed of all the important events that had transpired and the significant undercurrents and political whirlpools that had developed while he'd been away in the wilderness of Jebel Nagara. In the evening he started back towards the palace, taking the direct route along the bank of the river. The peasants, returning from their labours in the field, recognised him, made the sign for good luck and long life, and called to him, "Pray to Horus for us, Magus!" For they all knew that he was a Horus man. Many pressed small gifts upon him, and a ploughman called to him to share his dinner of millet cakes and crisply roasted locusts and goat's milk, warm from the udder.